Welcome, everyone. Episode 432 of the NBA Podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we're going to continue with our By Felicia series a little earlier than we anticipated because the Boston Celtics today announced the big news. Danny Ainge is stepping down as president of basketball operations. Brad Stevens, the head coach, is taking over, which means they have a new president, and they are now looking for a head coach. So we'll get into all of that, and then what's next for the Celtics in terms of their offseason. Later in the show, we'll also have David Ramil of Locked On Heat to discuss the same for the Miami Heat. Before we get into all that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We're being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And we are recording our show today on Locker Room, the only live audio social network for sports fans. Listen to our show on Locker Room before it hits your iTunes feed, engage with us in real time, or start your own room to react to the draft, trade news, and more. Take the mic and download Locker Room in the Apple App Store. Joining me today is a guy who I hope was not fooled by a ridiculous Danny Ainge quote slash expert excerpt, Morton Jensen. How's it going?
It's going on. No, I was not. I'm very pleased to say that I was apparently one of the few that didn't fall for a very, very obvious fake quote that apparently took Twitter by storm. Or we just have societies just reached that point, Brian, where we're that
different? I just wanted it to be true, but I was at least like, let me check the ESPN article to make sure. Because I didn't see the original person who tweeted it. I just saw our buddy Anthony Irwin of the every sort of Lakers podcast now, he tweeted just the one graph, and I was like, that can't possibly be true, but man, oh man, it was very funny.
And for people who are out there who don't really got a chance to see it, it was more or less a fake article snippet of someone photoshopped. I think it was actually, we actually know who did it. It was Tyler Conway, I think he was from who did that thing, and it basically said that Danny Ainge quit because of
the last stand was Kyrie stepping on the Celtics logo. Yeah.
Exactly, the logo incident, and him saying I kiss Lucky goodnight. it was so full of just dumb takes that I just, no, that's fake immediately. But apparently, like, a solid 40% of NBA Twitter was like, really? He did that? He said that? He kisses Lucky on the mouth? What?
He just wanted it to be true, but alas, it is not. Yeah. But more
desperately.
Let's just dive right in, because this news kind of trickled out quickly. Woj tweeted at like 9:30 in the morning that Ainge was considering resigning. And then shortly thereafter, he and a couple other people mentioned Brad Stevens was going to be moving into a front office role. Then all of a sudden it was, oh no, Ainge is definitely gone and Brad Stevens is the president. And then, oh no, Brad Stevens is giving up the head coaching job to be the president. So I think as we speak, the press conference is still going on, but it is official. Danny Ainge is stepping down. Brad Stevens is taking over the president of basketball operations. They will start a search for a new head coach. So what's your just general reaction to that entire change? I mean, you know, there, in theory, at least as far as we know right now, it sounds like Mike Zarin is going to stay on in Boston. I think when Ainge, you know, eventually did resign, I think it was widely assumed that Zarin would take over in that role. So assuming Zarin does stay, does that give you more confidence that Stevens is going to handle this transition well?
Yeah, I mean, so I was flabbergasted at seeing that Mike Zarin was not going to be automatically elevated to a certain position there, because that was always the assumption that when Ainge was over with, that he would get the big job. And honestly, I kind of think this is a weird thing, right? I mean, like, he turned down multiple job positions with other teams, but higher up, and for them to just kind of overlook him and go straight with Brad Stevens. I mean, I'm sure they talked to him about it, but still, that feels a little bit odd. But if he's cool with it, I mean, he grew up a Celtics fan, so maybe Zarin is just all in on the big green, and maybe that's just the way that he functions. Mm-hmm. In which case, yes, absolutely, he would be such a calming presence for Stevens in the first couple of years, transitioning into that role. Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm looking on their... Wow, they already updated the website, actually. The Celtics, their front office website. So Brad Stevens is currently listed as president of basketball operations now. Mike Zarin is VP of basketball operations and team council. So I was wondering if they would have him move into, like, become the official general manager instead. And maybe that's a promotion in terms of job title. And he's going to handle, like, you know, he's long been known as, like, the cap guru there. So I was wondering if he would kind of get that official title to, you know, basically handle the day-to-day roster construction. And then Stevens could focus more on, like, this player would be great. Mike, figure out how to make it work. But I don't know if that's going to be the case.
Yeah. Guess we'll find out.
It is. I mean, it's strange. I agree that it's, you know, I would have expected Zarin to get that promotion over Stevens. Or, you know, if anything, if they're concerned that they want to keep Stevens in the organization, but he's burned out on head coaching, which is what Woj tweeted, you know, move him into another role in the front office that is not president of basketball operations. It just seems wild that you have all these guys who have been putting in, you know, the years and have the experience to do this job, and instead you're giving it to a head coach with zero front office experience.
Yeah. Like last April of 2020, when the Bulls were looking for a brand new front office, I said as much at the time that I wanted Zarin as the GM. I thought that would be a great fit. And then of course I wanted Sam Hinkie as team president because I thought that he deserved a second chance. But in my eyes and most of the people who responded to those tweets when I was advocating for him was like, it's Zarin's time. It's Mike's era to begin with. And then now a year later he's being passed up on a chance you would think should have come by now for the Celtics. Like, again, he's turned down multiple job offerings from different teams for a higher title. So this is a little bit off, in my opinion. But like I said, Brian, maybe he's just bleeding green to the point where I don't care. I'll be the ball boy. It's fine.
It also just seems strange not to open the search beyond the organization. I mean, maybe they didn't want that sort of publicity around Ainge's departure, especially with a somewhat condensed offseason here. But, you know, like, for all we know, that Masai Ujiri still does not have a contract with the Raptors that goes beyond this season. Like, he could be 6 weeks away from leaving the Toronto Raptors. If you have a guy like that potentially on the market, wouldn't you want to go after him instead of Brad Stevens? I don't know. The decision-making here, I'd love to know what went into, you know, why are we promoting this guy into a role that he's never done before, has no experience, and we're not searching for outside candidates, one of whom is the most hotly pursued name on the market.
Do you think, though, that they did... I mean, I think they did some background.
Yeah.
I think they tried to do a little bit of background, and I think also... I mean, let's just be honest here. I don't think necessarily Boston is a great destination for Masai Ujiri.
That's fair. I mean, yeah, I'm sure they would at least reach out to his representation and probe any potential interest in coming there.
Yeah.
But I don't know, man. It's going to be fascinating to see how all of it plays out. I'll say that much.
Well, I mean, we already saw some rumors about Jason.
Yeah, right. So that's the other question is who they hire as the head coach. And Jason Kidd and Lloyd Pierce were among the candidates. I believe Chris Haynes of Yahoo was the one who reported that. I'm sure other names will pop up in due time. But
all in on Lloyd Pierce, all out on Jason Kidd. But for entertainment purposes, sure, why not?
Are there any other names that stick out to you who should be of interest?
David Vanderpool, Wes Unseld Jr., I think those two guys have been in the periphery for a couple of years. Might be a good time to actually do something about this now to see what they could do at the big job instead of always like using them for leverage or as leverage. I don't think that's fair. It seems every major coach always have like really positive things to say about these guys, which just makes me a little bit confused just in terms of if everyone is so like complimentary of these guys. Why is it that they're being used as leverage, as not being or not, and not being viewed as the big fish that you need to land?
Yeah, you're not going to get this reference because it's NFL instead of NBA. But Eric Bieniemy of the Kansas City Chiefs is a similar. Like, everyone raves about this guy. He's been in charge of like one of the league's best offenses for the last couple years. Gets interviews, does not get hired as the head coach. And it's just like, what are we missing here when the best quarterback of the league is saying this guy is the reason that our offense has been so electric? And it's Vanderpool, I know, has the full blessing of the Blazers guys, especially Dame and CJ. But, you know, we'll see what happens. For all we know, he's going to take over as the next head coach of the Blazers, because Terry Stotts is probably one game away from getting fired at this point.
Yeah, yeah. This won't be the only open seat. Let's just put it that way.
No. I would expect Scott Brooks will be handed his papers soon as well. So, I mean...
Well, Brian, you have to understand, Scott Brooks does give you analysis that no one else does by basically saying, in order to win a game, you need to score more points than the other team.
True.
If we're not making shots, we have to find other ways to score. Otherwise, it's going to be rough.
He was technically correct. And they did, in fact, score more points than the Sixers. So it was a well-timed pep talk for Scotty Brooks.
Hey, guys. So I have this crazy plan tonight. When you go out there, try to score than the other two.
Yeah.
Just.
Yeah. Boy. Yeah. So, all right. Well, regardless of who they hire as their head coach, this was already shaping up to be a fascinating offseason for the Celtics. And now, given the leadership change, Brad Stevens, I don't want to say he's inheriting a mess necessarily, but he's inheriting a complicated situation. They are probably either going to be right bumping up against the tax, or if Jason Tatum makes an all NBA team, they're already going to be over the luxury tax threshold. They have to, you know, they've traded for Evan Fournier at the trade deadline, used a big part of that trade exception. He's a free agent.
And who wants $20 million per year to return.
And then you also have, you know, you've got Marcus Smart heading into the last year of his deal. They have Tatum and Jaylen Brown are locked up on contracts through the next three seasons. So you've got your foundational pieces in place. But now it's a matter of filling out the roster around them. And more, before we go into free agency, I feel like we have to finally have the Kemba Walker conversation that we've been skirting around all year.
I thought I had it a couple weeks ago. But we can go into it. I mean, my stance hasn't changed. I think you need to get off of him right now. I only think this is going to get worse. This could be a Blake Griffin thing moving forward. Who was it who recently from The Athletic? Was it Jared Weiss? I think who reported earlier today that Kemba Walker league wide still has negative trade value.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah, no, I think it was Jared. Friend of the podcast. In fact, I remember he was on at one point. Who reported that, I believe, and that basically you would have to give up something to get off of Kemba. He is not a positive asset.
That was what I was going to ask, because, I mean, he missed the last two games of the playoff series against the Nets with this knee that has been bothering him basically all year. You know, he only played 43 regular season games as well. The production just wasn't quite there. You know, he averaged like 19 points, 5 assists, 4 rebounds, but just, I don't know. That wasn't like the Kemba Walker that they signed to a max contract. That wasn't the caliber of play that they were hoping to get from him.
Not even close. And look, that knee is bothering him. He's still a very, very small dude as well. This could get ugly, because if you lose your quickness and all that, and you're like 6 foot nothing, Brian, I mean, then defensively you're also going to be more than just a step behind. Then you're going to be small and slow. You can't be both in today's league. The fact that his knee is an issue would also mean moving forward that he won't be able to create as much separation off the dribble. And again, as someone who is that small, what do you really need to do in order to create your own shot? Well, you need to gain separation. So this could get ugly really, really quickly. So if there is a team out there completely desperate for point guard play, who is very short-sighted, really doesn't have great management, rate him to there.
Well, would you do it? I guess from the Celtics' perspective, would you give up assets to get off of him? And from another team's perspective, how much would you want to take him on? He's owed $36 million next year, $37.7 million player option in 22-23, which, you know, if the knee continues to bother him to this extent, I think you have to go in assuming that he's going to pick that up.
If I'm a different team, and the Celtics call me and they go, would you take on Kemba Walker? Like, we know you have cap space. Will you absorb Kemba Walker's contract? I'm asking for Robert Williams.
Interesting.
At the very least, actually. I'm thinking about it. I said that, and it didn't even feel as though that was...
Yeah, I don't think it is, because Robert Williams is up for an extension right now.
Yeah, he is. Aaron Nesmith as well, maybe? I don't know. I would ask for more. I would ask for quite a lot. Because it's not just the $36 million next season. It's the $37.6 million the year after. Mm-hmm. Because that's a player option. He's not going to turn that down. He'd be crazy to. Yeah. That is over $73 million over the next two seasons.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to get a substantial amount of assets back. And I think Robert Williams, just because he finally broke out a little bit, like, he looks like a keeper. But you're right. Given that he's up for an extension, then he's no longer a bargain deal, at least not a year into it after. So that would be Aaron Nesmith. And Romeo Langford isn't good enough to warrant that. Maybe even an additional draft pick. I mean, it's $73 million.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
I mean, they have the 16 pick in this year's draft. I can pull up their Real GM page. I'm guessing they have most, if not all, of their future picks as well. So they have assets to use to get off of that. Right. Yeah, they only owe a couple second-rounders to Charlotte. So, yeah, I mean, they've got all their first-round picks for the next 7 years. So they have flexibility if they want to get off that contract. And I think I agree with you. They need to at least explore it. I mean, if they don't have confidence that Kemba is going to get back to what he was a couple seasons ago, if this knee problem is just going to be chronic for the rest of his career, this is the problem with having three max guys. It gets really hard. Once you have those three guys on big contracts, it gets exceptionally difficult to fill out the roster around them. You just don't have a ton of avenues to do so. And this is where the Celtics are at. You know, they could package Marcus Smart in a Kemba deal to get off of him, but Marcus Smart only has 1 year left on his contract, and he's like the heart and soul of that team. So, you know, you're going to be losing a lot if you give him up. I found this Jared Weiss column that you referenced. It says multiple front office sources say they still view Walker as having negative trade value. That likely means the trade would cost the Celtics extra picks or assets to offload. He mentioned that apparently the Thunder have come up several times as a good fit for a potential salary dump, especially with the idea of Al Horford returning to Boston. So that's interesting, I guess. But again, if I'm OKC, I'm saying, sure, I'll do that deal. But you have to give me the 16 pick this year.
Right.
Yeah, I would ask for Robert Williams if I'm OKC, because they've got plenty of money to spend. And he's young enough that he could actually fit in, you know, long term next to SGA, and that's probably just the starting point.
Yeah, how long does Horford have?
2 years as well. 2 years, I believe. As well? Yeah,
yeah. Okay, you know what? Then I wouldn't do it if I'm Boston. I understand getting off of Kemba, but I wouldn't. I think it's time they lay off the old guys.
Brian. Yeah, that's certainly fair. Fournier is the other big decision they have to make this offseason. At least in terms of their roster next year. You're saying he's looking for around $20 million, which will just put them well into the luxury tax. And again, considering how it becomes increasingly punitive the further you go over. So once you're about $15 million over, that's where you start to get into hold your nose territory a little bit. One of the tricky things about this offseason is Tatum as well. If he makes that all-NBA team, he's going to get a $5.6 million raise. So he would push them into the tax already. So I almost think it depends on whether that happens with regard to how much you'd be willing to spend to retain Fournier. But what's your walk-away price if you're Boston on Evan Fournier?
20, probably. I mean, I think that's a little rich for someone who scores and shoots but does virtually nothing else. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and pretend like he isn't a great floor spacer. I'm also not going to sit here and pretend like he didn't have COVID. Right. I know people will point to his stats and go, well, see, $20 million. I understand that he's worth, you know, a substantial amount of money because of his scoring prowess, and his current statistics that you read about aren't really representative of who he is. At the same time, though, I just don't think $20 million for a guy like him is, at this point, a smart idea for the Celtics. I just don't. I understand the shooting aspect. I truly, I do. But you know what? Then I would rather take that money and spend them elsewhere and hope, cross my fingers and hope, that Aaron Nesmith is going to turn into that. Besides, Nesmith actually showed a little bit more defensive upside, I think, compared to what Evan Fournier, who is what, 28, will be 29 by next season. I mean, there's no defensive upside there with Fournier. Nesmith there is, so pivot onto Nesmith, I would say.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's tricky because Fournier, you know, in terms of what he, you're right, he brings shooting to the table. He shot 46.3% from three-point range, and all, you know, he played 16 regular season games with the Celtics, so small sample size, but he's a career almost 38% three-point shooter, and I feel like they acquired him to fill into that Hayward role, but he just isn't as good of a player as Gordon Hayward, and when you have Brown and Tatum, I understand you just want as many wings who can do a lot of things as possible, but I just don't know that Fournier is the same caliber of player. So you're right, when you've got an Aaron Nesmith signed to 3 more years at a reasonable rate, Fournier feels like a luxury more than a necessity at this point. But I almost wonder, I mean, it could be good in a way that they're transitioning from Ainge to Stevens right now, because I almost wonder if Ainge was the one still making that decision, if he would be more inclined to not necessarily overpay Fournier, but, you know, give him $20 million or even a little bit more than that, just to make sure that spending the trade exception on him doesn't come back to look like a mistake. Whereas Stevens could just say, you know what, blank slate, fresh start, we get that, we used it on, you know, we've got still like 11 or so million of that trade exception, but we used a grand majority of it on Evan Fournier. Oh, well, it didn't work out. We're moving on.
Yeah. I think that's a smart play if that's the price tag. Maybe they get together and they figure out something else. I really love the deal that he was on, the $17 million a year, Evan Fournier. I think that is reasonable, right? I mean, for someone who comes in and can give you roughly 20 points per game on great shooting, isn't that like $17 million worth?
Yeah, I mean, I think at that price, but again, this is where, you know, we're going into next year now. Look ahead to 2022. Robert Williams, if we don't sign him to an extension, he'll be a restricted free agent. Marcus Smart is also coming off the books. And again, if you can get off of Kemba, you suddenly have the money to make these types of things work.
Yeah, right.
But if you can't, then you've got Kemba at 37.7, Jaylen Brown at 27.2, Jason Tatum at 30.4. You know, those three guys alone are what, almost $90 million, more than $90 million in cap space. And then if you're bringing Fournier back at, you know, 15, 20 million, you're already like close to bumping up against next year's cap, and you have to worry about Smart and Robert Williams as well. So it's just, this is, you know, part of what makes roster building in the NBA so difficult, is that if you don't maximize the windows when you have guys on rookie contracts and they outperform those deals, and they, you know, that you want a Tatum and a Brown to develop into max caliber players, and they did. But once they get onto those contracts, all of a sudden it's just a lot more. Like, you're pretty much going to be limited most years to a mid-level exception.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe the biannual if you're under the tax. But other than that, you have to be really smart about your draft picks and, you know, your minimum signings. Like, you need to hit on a Bryn Forbes rather than spending 2 year non-taxpayer mid-level exception for Tristan Thompson, which looked like just an immediate mistake.
Maybe that's the play. That's actually an interesting angle. So they have all their young guys, but they also have young guys who you don't really know moving forward for main, you know, keepers, like Romeo Langford, for example. Like, what is he? Grant Williams, like, sure. Semi Ojeleye is probably not going to be returning at all. Like, there are some decisions to make about that group of players that have underwhelmed. Maybe it's just, like, gauge the trade market with those guys, see if there are teams out there who are like, oh yeah, 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 we believe in Romeo Langford. Let's give up something for Romeo Langford. And they get off of those contracts, and then they just reuse those roster spots to getting minimum contract veterans in. Because it's not a problem when you mix and match veterans with young guys, assuming, of course, that the veterans don't take up the same amount of cap space as Kemba freaking Walker. That was always their problem. It was that they dedicated that much salary to veterans when they had Tatum and Brown on the roster. Like, again, it's fine to mix and match, but don't go out of your way to sign someone who's like 10 years older to a major deal. It just doesn't make sense. Find the old guys for cheap. Go out and identify, like, the locker room guys, like the Garrett Temples, the Ed Davises, well, he's not playing anymore, but the Vince Carters, you know what I mean, right? Those type of people. Get them for, like, $3 to $5 million if you have to go above the min, and then spend the rest of your money on players who are age-appropriate to Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. Problem freaking solved. Yeah.
Easier said than done, but yeah.
Is it, though? Is it, though? Like, right now, you could say it's difficult because they're in that situation that they built for themselves, but it was always dumb. You and I were harping on this for the day that they actually got Gordon Hayward. We were like, why? This doesn't really make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I hate to keep bringing it back to the failed sign-and-trade for Hayward, but how much better would the Celtics team look right now if you had Miles Turner signed to, you know, how much is at least another couple of years on his deal, right? Yeah, two more years at $18 million a pop.
Right. That's not a bad contract whatsoever. It's fine. That's what I'm talking about, Brian. That's the good contracts. Those are, like, he's on a non-rookie contract, so he's obviously into his extension, but he's young enough to be on the same timeline as Jaylen Brown, as Jason Tatum. That's how you spend that money. You don't go in and get guys who suddenly drops off while the other guys are, like, ascending. It just makes no sense because you're losing out on a trade asset. But by having those old guys play that much of a role and clog up that much of the cap space, because then when those guys are so old that they can't really play anymore, you have to get rid of them, then Jaylen and Jason are already into their extensions, so they're taking up so much cap space that you can't really afford to go out and find another key piece. Like, team building, I understand what you're saying, easier said than done, but overall, team construction shouldn't be that difficult. It's about understanding timelines and financials. I mean, that's team building 101.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I think the problem, as Boston has seen in recent years, is that it only takes one team to screw up your plans, right? So, like, Al Horford, a couple of years ago, he turns down that player option, where we're like, oh, that's weird, but maybe he's going to sign a longer-term deal. And then in come the Sixers, who offer him more money than the Celtics were comfortable paying him, and all of a sudden that you just, like, they've hemorrhaged marquee talent between Kyrie, Horford, and Hayward, and don't have much, if anything, to show for it right now.
No, you're absolutely right, but at the same time, they didn't know at that point in time that Jason and Jaylen in particular would be this good.
Yeah.
I think they had an inclination about it, that, especially from Tatum's perspective. But the fact that they became this good and then they still end up signing Kemba Walker a couple years ago, that to me was egregious. Like, why would you go out and get someone at that age group? Like, when we talked about it, we said at the same time, I remember when we talked about it, it was, we think he was going to be an upgrade over Kyrie from a player, or not a player perspective, but a locker room perspective and a leading perspective and all of that. But the age was a concern. Mm-hmm. Like, it just didn't align from an age perspective. It had to hit home. It had to be the exact right signing. He had to stay healthy. Now we're in a situation 2 years later. He's not fully healthy. You can see his age. You can see his cap number, how much... Like, that's going to sting by having to give it up. So they need to do something else now. They need to get off of that contract, and I'm not saying by any means necessary, but they need to get something aligned. If they waste the primes of Brown and Tatum, good Lord.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm not all gloom and doom here because I think there are ways to do it, but, you know, 3 years left on Jaylen Brown's contract, it's not... an infinite amount of time. Like Tatum, you've got locked up for a long time.
Yeah.
This window with Brown and Tatum is not as long as it might otherwise feel. But, you know...
2024, you're right. Yeah. 3 years.
But look, they've had a ton of success with those two guys as the centerpieces already. I'm not ruling out the Celtics as becoming, you know, back into that top tier of Eastern Conference contender if Kemba can get back to what he was before, if they can retain Fournier... or if they flip Kemba for something else, sign and trade Fournier somewhere else, you know, like there are options here, but it's a lot for a first time president of basketball operations. So Godspeed, Brad Stevens. If you felt burnt out as a coach, you are inheriting quite a mess right now.
One final question before we move on from the Celtics to you, Brian, because I'm curious just to where you're standing on this. I understand. I brought him up earlier, like, Robert Williams. I think he's tremendous, but he's obviously not on the level of Tatum or Brown. If you're Brad Stevens and you're looking at this roster, is there not only two keepers? And you could argue on the bubble Marcus Smart, but you just don't know what he's trying to command for next contract. But push comes to shove. If you just start the roster over, it's Tatum and Brown and no one else, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can make an argument. You know, I wouldn't say, like, I'm definitely getting off of some of the young guys, but I don't think any of them have cemented themselves as this could be the third piece of a big three with Tatum and Brown. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. Like, you can probably survive getting rid of every single player on the roster, but those two.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe that's actually, like, you brought it up just in terms of getting off of Kemba's contract. Maybe that's the pill you swallow this summer. Maybe you just go, okay, Romeo Langford, Grant Williams, number 16, take it. Or someone else, maybe even Robert Williams or whatever. Just take it. Get out of Kemba's contract. Get clean books. Start a little bit afresh with just Tatum and Brown, and you just go, we build from there. That's our priority. And every decision that we make from there on is tailored around those two.
Totally agree there. So joining us now, we will pivot to the Miami Heat. And joining us to discuss that is David Ramil of Locked On Heat. David, how are you?
Oh, pretty good. The season came unexpectedly short, close to an end there for Miami. But other than that, everything is going great.
Yeah, that's good to hear. You get your vacation time starting early, so that's nice at least.
Yeah.
Before we get underway here, can you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and where they can find your work?
Sure. They can find my personal account at Twitter at DRamil13, and then they can follow the Locked On Heat podcast at Locked On Heat via Twitter. And that's mostly where I post anything Heat related if you're interested in that sort of thing.
Very good. All right. Yeah. Please give David a follow. The Heat are going to be certainly a fascinating team to watch this offseason, which we'll get into shortly. But first, we just need to get into kind of what happened to this team this year. Coming off of the finals run last year, you know, obviously COVID affected the Heat more than most teams. But was that what derailed this team, David? Or what else contributed to, you know, them kind of scuffling their way through the regular season and then, you know, getting swept by the Bucks in the playoffs?
Well, Bam Adebayo kind of mentioned this in his post-game presser after Game 4's loss. And, you know, he hinted at a lot of the things that you talked about and also the things that are pretty, endemic to almost every team, where they had a lack of consistency. They didn't make many improvements to the roster. In fact, they got worse in the offseason, I think. They didn't sign Jay Crowder. They let Derrick Jones Jr. go to Portland and things of that sort. And their only additions were Avery Bradley and Mo Harkless. That didn't really pan out either. So the roster got significantly worse in the offseason. Then on top of that, as you mentioned, COVID did hit the team early on. Jimmy missed some time with injury. They just never really kind of developed any kind of sort of chemistry, and they were really redefining themselves and trying to find their identity at various points throughout the season, and it just never really worked out for them. Towards the end of the year, they were probably playing their best basketball, at least offensively, and then defensively, they weren't playing pretty well at all. They were actually really badly playing badly defensively, and so that was a big issue for them, is that they never really seemed to kind of get any kind of footing when it came to that roster. They were also relying on older guys like Trevor Ariza, who they added late in the season, Dwayne Dedmon, who they added as a signee late in the season. Those guys weren't exactly expected to be major contributors, and yet the team had to rely on them because there was nobody else. And it was just, they didn't get the kind of contributions from other players like Tyler Hero and guys like that they expected to take a leap this year. It just wasn't enough time for them to really continue developing throughout the course of the season. And so by the time they face a much more talented team in Milwaukee in the playoffs, things unraveled very quickly, as everybody witnessed.
Yeah. I mean, going into that series, Mort and I were kind of the mindset that, you know, yes, it was a rematch from last year, but Milwaukee got better with the addition of Jrue Holiday. And as you mentioned, the Heat got worse, not only with losing Jay Crowder, who was so instrumental to that run to the finals last year, but, you know, getting rid of Kelly Olynyk at the trade deadline for Victor Oladipo, who then only played four games before he got hurt as well. Do you think, I have seen this, you know, trending a bit on Heat Twitter, do you think Oladipo would have made a difference in that series, or were they still looking at, you know, maybe not getting swept, but like Bucks in five, Bucks in six, even if they had a whole healthy Oladipo?
That was me. That Bucks Twitter was roasting pretty heavily because of that take. I said he was actually a key player, and I think he would have been. Like you saw in the four games, clearly he was going to struggle because you never knew whether or not he was going to have any kind of great offensive impact. But defensively, he had been just as good as he ever had been, and I think you probably have a guy like Oladipo out there, it's less likely that Jrue Holiday or Bryn Forbes or Dante DiVincenzo go off for a big game. And I think that's the whole, you know, that's the whole thought process behind whether or not Oladipo would have been able to contribute. In fact, his last game against the Lakers, a victory for Miami, he played really, really well. And then all of a sudden he got hurt. And of course, then he just missed the rest of the season. And who knows when he'll ever come back, what kind of player he'll be. But I thought, the way the team was trending, they were going to be playing much more effectively defensively, and Oladipo was a big part of that. They could continue switching. He pressures guards and ball handlers along the perimeter. I think he's a guy who can switch on occasion too. He was great at intercepting passes and you know, leading the league in steals alongside Jimmy Butler. It would have been a really nice addition to that team. So to me, I thought he would have at least made an impact, if not necessarily swing the series, but at least he would have been a positive factor for Miami. On, you know, they didn't get a lot of positivity out of them in the playoffs, so it would have been nice to get a guy like Oladipo contributing somehow.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing you say here is that it's Victor Oladipo's fault that Bryn Forbes outscored Jimmy Butler.
Absolutely. Yeah, pin it on Victor all along. I think that's fair.
Do you think the criticism that Jimmy's been facing from that playoff series is justified?
Justified? That's kind of tough to answer because, like, to me, you know, I don't think he talked excessively. I think a lot of it is made out of every comment he makes, because, of course, a lot of this is kind of performative art when it comes to Jimmy, as far as the long practices and the fact that he's stupidly locked in. And, of course, the photo that the team is just as guilty for. Like, they tweeted out this photo of him with, I don't know if that's excessive photoshopping or not, with like all this veinature and sweat from muscles. Hours of working out. It's like, we know you work out. Everybody in the NBA works out. That's not necessary for you to post that. So I don't know exactly where to draw the line when it comes to Jimmy. I know that he does put in the time, obviously. But I've listened to your show. A lot of the time you guys kind of looked at Miami's early season struggles and you kind of dismissed them. You just said, well, you know, they'll figure it out. I'm not worried about Miami. They'll figure it out. And I was alone in the same boat. I thought they would absolutely figure it out. mostly because of Jimmy. I thought he was going to be able to turn it up a notch. You saw what he did last year in the playoffs. You saw what he did in the finals specifically. And you're thinking, well, we're going to get a superstar performance out of him to at least prevent a sweep, you know, and that didn't exactly work out. And so I don't know if it was just physical, mental exhaustion, which is a totally legitimate excuse, but he did not look like the kind of player that we saw last year. And as such, I don't think he deserves any kind of roasting or ribbing, but I think it's maybe it's not necessarily unfair, but it's not, I can understand why it's taking place too. People were waiting to kind of pounce on Jimmy and kind of prove that maybe he's not the superstar a lot of people believed he was.
Well, I mean, I was driving the superstar wagon for a long time, so you won't hear any of that out of me. And Brian is just bitter because he didn't retain Jimmy Butler for his team because he was actually playing pretty well there. Joel Embiid loved him. So that's just sour grapes on Brian's part. You don't pay no mind to that. But I do think it's important that I think, David, you bring up a very good point. So as a former Bulls fan, obviously, I also saw Jimmy for an extended period of time. All of us have had or have certain team preferences that have all had Jimmy Butler on the roster. And I think we all of the three of us know that what Jimmy says isn't always necessarily what is, let's say, representative of what's going on. I mean, he is just, he's a different cat, right? Like, he's just not wired in the same way as these political, correct NBA players. He's a guy who says, I'm working, I'm trying to build a brand, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And he's one of the few guys who actually backs up his claim. So for the one time that he didn't during a playoff series, it's just people are looking at that as going, okay, now the house is on fire, the bricks are coming down upon him, it's karma. It's no. I mean, look, this guy played 52 games in the regular season. The Heat were 33-19 while he played. That's objectively a fantastic record. For them to go 0-4, I didn't even expect that. I really didn't. They just ran into a Bucks team that was perfectly tailored to match every weakness that they had, or just basically nullify every strength that they had. Sometimes we just need to chalk it up to a bad matchup, and I think this was it. Milwaukee is just that good. This isn't a question of Jimmy or the Heat being this bad. This is a question of the Bucks just being that tremendous.
I agree with that 100%. At the same time, though, and maybe this feels like, I'm sure some Milwaukee fans would probably say that this is somewhat homerish, but a lot of the shots that they made last year in the playoffs, they just didn't make. And it's hard to explain. If anything, like Jimmy missed like bunnies at the rim. He wasn't getting to the line. Obviously, last year in the playoffs against Milwaukee specifically, I think he averaged close to 11 free throw attempts per game. He didn't get those kind of calls this time around. He just wasn't knocking down the jumper. He wasn't getting past Brook Lopez as effectively. And I don't know if it was just the long, you know, in 18 months, they compressed two seasons for this team. And obviously they went as deep as anybody aside from the Lakers. And so there was a lot there. I don't know if he just kind of bogged down. I don't think he could continue to carry the team the way we had expected him to. And I you know, credit to Milwaukee's defense, but Miami also just failed to capitalize on opportunities that were absolutely available from him. And that's not just Jimmy, that's Duncan Robinson, that's Bam, and on and on and on. These guys were just not knocking down open jumpers that they had been throughout the season and certainly in the last year's playoffs.
Or even taking them. I think we're being super harsh on Jimmy, not us, but like the media is being super harsh on Jimmy and not really acknowledging that Bam Adebayo had so many wide open mid-range jump shots that he just did not take. He looked like Wendell Carter Jr. out there, just not even looking at the basket at times. And this is what Brian and I have had this talk so many times on this podcast, Bam is a guy with such a clean shooting mechanic that there's no just cause for him to not pop that mid-range midi. I know it's not a great shot, but if you are in a defensively oriented fight, you need to squeeze out points in whatever capacity you can. You can't necessarily say, oh, I'm only trying to score at the rim or going for the three-point line or any of that. Like, he had so many mid-range jump shots that he could have taken, and he just didn't. And I'm not one of those guys who just, like, will take that and go, well, then he's a bad NBA player. But I do think it's fair to say that is not something that we can see be duplicated next year or in the years coming after this one. This is something that he needs to fix this summer. He has to come back next year and actually hit those shots or just take them. Start by taking them, and then we can talk about hitting them later on.
It's not even, to your point, it's not even making them, because he does. And we saw this progression from him in the bubble last year. Like, he made huge leaps in the bubble as far as being able to knock down that mid-range jumper. And it's the taking them. And look, two things about that. Milwaukee, clearly their defense designed to give up those mid-range shots. And so that space was open for them. He couldn't knock him down. Kendrick Nunn couldn't knock them down. Jimmy couldn't knock them down. It was very weird to see those shots that were open and available not fall for this team. But in Bam's case, it's such a difficult balance for him because he's such a great playmaker and he's such a big part of what Miami's offense is built around. He's the hub of their offense, from passing from the elbow and creating opportunities, dribble handoffs with Duncan and so on and so on. And then when he does have the ball, he's holding it and he kind of gets that feeling where he's trying to create offense for everybody else. But at some point he has to learn how to be aggressive and looking for his shot. And look, that's a common complaint from Heat fans, that he never takes that leap. I remember interviewing Chris Bosh a couple of years ago and him saying the same thing. Like, when it comes to Bam, he's got all the tools. He just needs to be aggressive and put it all together. And it's been, you know, year four now. Look, he's only 23. We know he's going to continue to develop and everything else like that. It was a very tense moment in that presser that I referenced before, where a reporter from Miami asked him, you know, what, you know, we've seen this kind of thing from you in the past. What needs to be added to your game? And Bam kind of flipped the question back at the reporter. It was very awkward and uncomfortable there for a second. But the answer was a mid-range shot. And I don't know, that's kind of reductive, because he has that mid-range shot available to him. So I just don't know what Bam needs to add as far as his bag is concerned, his offensive repertoire, because he does have a good shot. He does have a smooth mechanics, as you mentioned. It's just about the willingness to take that shot and understand when to defer, when to create for others, and when to be aggressive and look for your opportunities.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the good news for Miami, if you want to look at it that way, is that they are poised to be one of the bigger players this offseason, especially in free agency. I'm taking these numbers from Bobby Marks of ESPN. They are poised to have about $21 million in cap space. That could go up to $27 million if they pull the qualifying offers for Kendrick Nunn and Duncan Robinson, which they would basically do to create an extra $3 million each. But they would only do that, I mean, you know, they would tell Duncan, like, we're going to re-sign you. Don't sign an offer sheet somewhere else. Or don't, I guess you wouldn't even be a restricted free agent at that point. Don't leave us. We're going to re-sign you. We're just doing this to create cap space. So before we go into specific targets, David, what do you think, just generally, either positionally or in terms of skill sets, what do you think Miami needs to add to the roster this summer?
It starts off, I think, to me, at the 1-5, and I think a lot of people would probably be surprised at that. But given what we saw from him against Milwaukee, I don't know that you can continue to start Bam at the 5. I think it's asking for a little bit too much. And if not necessarily, you know, again, because these positions are somewhat interchangeable, you just need a floor spacing big, which Miami does not have. When you have Trevor Ariza out there, unable to hit a shot, you know, you had Myers Leonard starting last year, but obviously that's no longer an option. You trade away Kelly Olynyk for Victor Oladipo. There weren't any kind of floor spacing big out there to make a difference and complement Bam and his playmaking ability. So I think that's a big part of it. And then also, yes, a point guard, somebody who can actually initiate offense for others, you know, take the ball out of Jimmy's hands somewhat, where he can play a little bit more off ball, get more back cuts and things of that sort, where he can get easier looks at the rim, where he doesn't have to, you know, draw the defense in and draw fouls in order to be an effective offensive player. So I think that would be a big help. Obviously, Miami's offense looks generally better when you have a real point guard like Goran Dragic in the lineup. But, you know, at his age, he can't get the starting nod anymore. Kendrick Nunn is never going to be that kind of, you know, pass first point guard or anything like that. So I think 1-5 is generally where you want to have, you know, if you're going to make any additions to this team, that's probably where you'll start.
Well, so obviously the player at the 1 that is going to be linked incessantly to Miami is Kyle Lowry, one of Jimmy Butler's best friends. It sounds like, you know, they would probably have to commit, unless he's willing to take a major discount, of course, but, like, you know, most likely they would be spending most, if not all, of their cap space on Lowry if they're going to go after him. So do you think that is a wise use of their resources, or should they try to divvy it up a little bit more and go after some cheaper targets so they can address both positions and fill out their roster with more depth?
Yeah, I'd lean towards the latter there. I love Kyle, obviously. I think a lot of people do. But, you know, his priority is to win now, as is the franchise's, as is Jimmy's. But I just don't know that Miami presents the best opportunity to do so. So I'd have to question whether or not Kyle is as interested in Miami as Miami is in Kyle. Mm-hmm. But, you know, removed from that, you know, his age is a consideration. Does he make Miami significantly better? Yeah, I guess to a certain degree. At the same time, I don't know if you want to necessarily pay him as much as it might take for him to join this team. Now, look, a lot of players can get, you know, take discounts and maybe try to re-sign with his team. Maybe Kyle is willing to take less money to join Miami. Obviously, the lack of state income tax plays a factor there. So maybe what would be a larger deal elsewhere would be a smaller one in Miami. Maybe that's something he'd consider. To me personally, I would rather divvy it up a little bit because I think they just need to add more depth, because that was a big problem for Miami, is that you wonder whether or not Eric Spoelstra can make changes to adjust to what Milwaukee was doing. But then you look at that roster and there just wasn't anybody there. Nobody had taken that leap as far as their young players were concerned. They just didn't have any kind of, you know, proven veterans that could go in there and make a change. So to me, I would prefer that they go the depth route anyway.
Mm. Yeah. So Devontae Graham and Daniel Theis confirmed then.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds like a great fit in Miami.
So they also have a couple of their own free agents that they need to either consider re-signing or let walk. To create this cap space, first of all, they've got to renounce or decline the team options on Goran Dragic and Andre Iguodala. And then you've got Kendrick Nunn, Duncan Robinson, who you mentioned earlier, and then also Victor Oladipo. So let's start with Depot because, you know, there were rumors about his interest in Miami for, I feel like, years before he wound up there. Yep. At the trade deadline. Unfortunately, suffers the injury to the same right quad tendon that he had back in Indiana. So do you have any sense of whether Miami is interested in retaining him, and, you know, what a realistic price point is that they would be willing to meet for him?
As far as a price point, no. The interest, you know, somewhat, because I think part of acquiring him when they did was to kind of test whether or not Oladipo was going to be healthy and to see whether or not he could be a long-term addition when he enters free agency. And unfortunately, he failed that test, you know, through no fault of his own. But I think there are concerns there from the franchise. I think they'd want to bring him back, but they'd obviously want to bring him back at a pretty cheap kind of prove me deal, where maybe like a one-on-one with a player option there, or a team option rather, so that they could re-sign him at a later time, or a player option actually, where he could, if he winds up bouncing back and he's healthy and he's a solid contributor, then, you know, maybe they'll re-sign him to a longer term deal in the future. But I don't know that Victor would want to take that chance. I just don't know what the market is for him either. Do you guys get any sense of that? Because you look around the league and who's going to offer him a multi-year deal, given what we've seen from him and his injury history? And I just don't know that there's a lot of options out there. He might not have many. He might not have any other choice but to just stay in the city where he wants to be. And I know that that's the case. I mean, he obviously patterns his game a lot on, like, Dwayne Wade. There's a close relationship there. I saw that relationship, you know, playing out over the years, and I thought he was a natural fit in Miami. Unfortunately, the injuries had just limited his impact. So to me, I think he'll probably re-sign for a short-term deal and then see whether or not he eventually bounces back, because I just don't see what the market will be for him. And I know Miami would love to have him back, again, just from the perspective of, we can add a defensive player, we can add a proven veteran, one who wants to be here and wants to win. And, you know, it's as long as it's a low-risk addition, you know, in terms of what you're paying him.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a good sense of his market either. There aren't a ton of teams, you know, like the Knicks are going to have cap space, the Mavericks will have cap space, the Spurs will have cap space. Like, OKC does, but I don't know why you're spending money on Victor Oladipo if you're OKC.
Yeah,
right.
And like Charlotte, same deal. I mean, they're pretty set in the backcourt already. So there just aren't a ton of teams with cap space that he would fit a need for. And like the Knicks, I guess that would probably be you could make the best argument for them.
Really? But,
well, I mean, they're just going to have so much money. I know. I mean, I'm not saying they're going to give him like 3 years, $50 million or anything like that. But if Oladipo's options, regardless of where he's signing, are a 1 year deal, the Knicks at least have the spending power to offer him 1 year, $10 million, or 1 year, $12 million.
Do you know he's playing though? Do we know if he's playing next year?
Yeah, there was a report that said he's going to be healthy by November, I thought.
Yes. Yeah, that's okay. That's at least if he, you know, progresses the way everybody expects him to, then yes, he'll be around.
Oh, okay. that because that stands in pretty stark contrast to the first report that came out saying that he might miss the entire next year. Okay. All right. Then you know what? Then I'll backtrack a little bit. If that's the case that he will play next year, then I'm feeling much more confident about any team trying to sign. I was under the impression that there was still this risk factor of him maybe missing, if not all of the year, then maybe something along the lines of 80-90% of the year, in which case it just would not entertain that idea whatsoever.
Yeah.
But even from his perspective, like, would you want to join a team where you have to go through this process again? And we saw it in Indiana, right? Where he came back and he was allegedly healthy, and then still it was a prolonged timetable for him to actually return, be integrated, and be a significant contributor. At least from my perspective, I would think that he would prefer staying in a place like Miami where there's already experience there, where he knows the roster, and he can kind of slowly work his way back and not be relied on as heavily. So I'm curious to see what his thought process is. It's not tragic necessarily, but it's unfortunate for him and his career to see it go the way it has, because obviously he was a very good player a few years ago, and to see any player have their career just ruined by injury the way it has, I'm not sure what's in his future will be like, but I wonder whether or not it'll be in Miami.
Yeah. I remember when the initial report came out, Brian and I were DMing, and I shared their link with Brian, and Brian was like, does he even get a contract next year? I mean, that's where we were. Like that's the mindset that we were in. And so for him to just, if he sticks with Miami I have no idea what the monetary amount is going to be. Like, it could be something insane or it could be something entirely reasonable, somewhere in between. I really have no clue.
They won't offer him insane money. Like, they can't.
Right.
Yeah. I think they know enough about the extent of his injury and everything else. And while Pat Riley isn't afraid to play chicken with a player. You know, I know he's made some mistakes in the past, obviously, but you know, if Oladipo's agents say, no, we want 20 million a year, it's like, well, go and get it wherever you
want. Right. Yeah.
It's not going to be here. That's for sure. So, I mean, I can imagine something, you know, maybe a 2-year, $14, $15 million deal with, again, with that player option there, and see if he's healthy and a contributor, and then he can re-sign elsewhere next season.
That sounds reasonable.
Teams are going to have some version of the mid-level exception, so either around $6 million or like $9.5 million. So, you know, I think some team would take a flyer on him potentially if they see him, like maybe Golden State sees him as, you know, we can rehab his value and he can be this kind of explosive third guard off the bench, and we can rehab both him and Clay together. I'm just throwing it out there as one team that might be gambling on the upside, even though
they rehab bros.
Yeah, they know there's risk there. Let's go to the restricted free agents, David, because Duncan Robinson is the big one, but Kendrick Nunn, too. There was a report from John Hollinger of The Athletic that he could be looking at offers in the $15 million a year range. He said Robinson could perhaps get even more than that. So if you were Miami, would you be trying to bring back one of those guys, both of those guys, and what? How much would you be willing to spend on either one?
I don't know about Kendrick. You know, obviously, I think that's well, the story is complicated, as you both know, I'm sure.
Yes.
But
yes,
it's good to see him. If he's moved on from his past, the alleged past of, you know, his incidents and everything else, that's fine. You want to see him succeed if that's truly the case. And he's a fine player, capable of doing some things offensively, you know, as far as his scoring. But he is a score first and last player. He's not going to make plays for others. His defense is pretty woeful. And given that, there are limitations there. And yes, he can improve because he's young and everything else. But I just, considering his physical limitations, I'm just not sure how much of a trajectory there is for him. So if from the Miami side of things, I think they would be comfortable letting him walk. Because they've proven that they can bring in another guy and develop them and continue to kind of just plug in that role there, as they have so often in the past. So for Kendrick, again, similar to what I was talking about with Oladipo, probably somewhere under $10 million. I can't see any role where they would offer him more than that. If he can get $15 million a year elsewhere, again, go and get it, because it's not going to be from Miami. Now, Duncan, however, that's a little different story. I think they're pretty aware of what he can do, and his impact on offense is great. They've seen improvement from him on the defensive end. The playmaking will never be there, but he's a smart player. He's capable. And again, defensively, he's gotten better. He's not as bad. He's still being targeted, but I think he can hold his own. We even saw him hold his own against the Bucks on occasion. You know, he can body up bigger guys. He can, you know, stay with smaller players too. So I think there's room there, even though he's a little bit older. And again, you just can't pass up that shooting. And while you have a guy like, you know, Max Strus on the roster, and maybe you can find another diamond in the rough, you're probably not going to get anybody who's capable of putting up historically great numbers the way Robinson did last year and this year. Look, like everybody sees that he took a drop off, but you're, when you're talking about historically great and then whatever follows that is going to look like pale in comparison. But the reality, he was still really good and a major part of what Miami's offense is based on. So for Duncan, you know, we're seeing reports of close to $18, $20 million somewhere along the Joe Harris type contract. I'd hope that they would keep it closer to $15 million. You know, yesterday his comments during exit interviews is that what he's looking for in free agency is fit above all else. Mm-hmm. It's hard to kind of interpret that because clearly there's a fit in Miami, but I wonder whether or not he sees that maybe he could be a better or better utilized elsewhere. I don't know if his role is necessarily limited in Miami, but he's never going to be the star here considering you have Bam and Jimmy on the roster already. So I'm curious to see what his thought process is. I've always thought that he'd probably prefer playing closer to home. That's the Celtics. I don't even know if that's a possibility for them. I don't know if they could add a player like that, but I'm sure they would love to get a guy with his skill set on that roster too. I think there's mutual interest from Robinson and the Heat, but I would hope that the franchise recognizes that they can't overpay for a guy like that unless they see some huge leap that he's capable of taking over the next season or two. For now, I think I would probably keep it closer to the $15 million per year range.
Yeah. I mean, David, I'll translate for you what best fit is. It's where he gets paid the most.
Yeah. It certainly won't hurt.
Yeah. By the way, that's a big part of it. Yeah. I can imagine. I mean, what team is going to pay $20 million a year for Duncan Robinson?
Oh, many.
You think so?
The Knicks I could see do it. I really could. They need more spacing next to Randall.
The Knicks are paying everybody more.
Smart play. Brian and I do often mention the Knicks, but it's true that they have, what, 55 million in cap space? Something along those lines, 55 million? 50 at least. Yeah, and if 20 million gets you Duncan Robinson, that's only 40% of your cap space, and you get an elite floor spacer who gives you so much space for Julius, who gives you space for RJ. There would be a very positive ripple effect here. Though working in your favor, I guess, is the fact that they're looking for a point guard, which he obviously isn't. But if he's on the market, like, he's one of those game-changing offensive players. I think you would kind of bend your team a little bit to make him fit. I think a lot of teams would pay him 20, to be honest with you. I really do, especially considering he's in his prime years. They won't have to wait around. I mean, they are getting him, like, in the middle of his prime. What is it, 26, 27 to, like, 30, 31?
Yeah. It's just funny to hear that kind of outsider's perspective because you get immersed in the Heat fandom and Twitter and everything else, and like, there are obvious limitations to what Duncan can do. And while there's respect for his shooting, there's also the fact that he just doesn't do a lot of things very well. And yeah, you hope that
Lauri Markkanen flashbacks. Grow. Sorry.
I mean, but Duncan's a better shooter than Markkanen ever had.
Oh, yeah. I agree. I know the feeling. Like, someone who can shoot but doesn't really do a whole lot else. But he can stretch defenses to an extent that virtually no one else but Curry can, I would argue.
That's fair. I mean, like, his ability to get that shot off, that release is so quick. It's a joy to watch him play. When he's got it going, he's as dangerous a player as there is in the NBA, which is kind of weird to say for a guy who went undrafted. And, you know, obviously it's a great story, it's going to be a tough decision for him and for the franchise.
All we know is he better not go to Philly because his 3-point field goal percentage is going to drop to like the mid-20s.
Yeah, luckily Philly cannot afford him, but Dallas is another team that I could see pursuing him, putting him next to Luka.
Yeah, if they don't get DeRozan, they want DeRozan, but if they don't get DeRozan and Duncan is there for the taking for the Mavs, good Lord, that would be incredible.
It's a lot of offense over there. I don't know if it's going to help them defensively, which is the biggest issue, right? But
doesn't matter. They would average 130.
Yeah, they just follow the Nets strategy. all right, David, as we wrap up here, just give a general sense of, like, how are you feeling about the Heat going into this offseason? Like, how do you think Heat fans should feel? You know, obviously, losing in the being swept in the first round sucks. That's very demoralizing. But you know, you have this opportunity to make a big change this offseason. Like, how do you see this playing out?
Not well, to be honest with you. Yeah, I feel like the schedule for this team, the timetable, kind of changed last year when they made that unexpected run to the finals. And obviously you can debate whether they were bubble frauds or whether they just took advantage of a tough situation better than anybody else. But it changed considerably. And look, they promised Jimmy a championship. He signs with that team because he believed that they could get him a ring. They thought enough of Bam Adebayo that, you know, maybe he could help and complement what Jimmy could do. But I just, you look at the players they currently have, and they're all, aside from Jimmy and Bam, who are so good and versatile, everybody else feels like they're one-dimensional and they just don't do anything else particularly well other than the one thing they do well. And the problem was in the playoffs, they didn't do it well, that one thing. And so that led to, obviously, the four-game sweep there. But you see them moving forward, and I'm just not sure how they're going to build the roster. Now, that's kind of putting Pat Riley and discounting what he's been able to do in the past. And you know he's going to be able to swing for the fences. That's always been the goal there. But you don't have a lot on this roster. You can't keep trading away first-round picks, especially when you don't have many to trade away. There's nobody else in the roster that's worth, you know, including in a huge deal. Like, a lot has been made about Tyler Hero not being included in a trade for James Harden, but the reality was they didn't have the picks to add to Tyler Hero's ass. They would have thrown him to Houston happily if it would have gotten them James Harden. They just didn't have the rest of the package put together. And so I wonder, looking at this roster, what they can do. And maybe Kyle Lowry comes to Miami, takes a cheaper deal to play alongside his friend. They compete. They're a good team. But even that team seems like it has limitations, right, given their age, the injuries and things of that sort. And, you know, you're hearing talk about Jimmy Butler's contract extension, and some other people are questioning whether or not he'd want out of Miami and things of that sort. And I don't buy that for an instant, but I just don't know what the ceiling for this team is moving forward. Bam has to take a huge leap, and I just don't know that he's capable of that either, given what we saw from him in the playoffs. You know, he has to expand his offensive repertoire while still incorporating those aspects of his game that make him so good, the playmaking and everything else. So they have a lot of decisions to make. They have to find a way to retool this roster completely. And given that, that's a lot to ask for this team. They have enough time, and you hope that they'll come back hungry and ready to make significant improvements, but allow that depends on the offseason. And that's kind of, you know, that's a difficult gamble because you don't know what you're going to be able to get, if you're going to be able to get anything. And last year they made that gamble too, where they said, you know, let's run it back, because they went to the finals, and obviously within a 2 month span they went from playing in the finals in Orlando to restarting the season, and they didn't make positive changes, and clearly it bit them in the ass. So I don't know if, you know, given that you have to make another gamble this year, whether or not they'll be able to succeed, whether they'll win. And if that's the case, I'm not sure what this team looks like moving forward, because you have an older Jimmy Butler, you've got Bam getting paid a lot of money and maybe not necessarily taking that leap. Duncan looks fine as a player, but again, you know, you're paying him a lot of money for basically his shooting, which is fine. But there's questions about this roster, and I'm just not as positive as them. A lot of Heat fans are looking at this team and saying, we're going to make a big splash in free agency, we're going to add this player and that player. It's like, well, that's not a guarantee by any stretch. You know, you don't have a lot to trade for a potential star to complement what Jimmy and Bam can do, and you need that. If nothing else, the Milwaukee series proved that they're not the kind of superstars that can take over, especially against a team that's as dominant and talented as Milwaukee was.
And we'll get into Jimmy Butler and contract specifics on YouTube, where we have an extended interview with David. For now, though, thank you so much, David, for coming on the podcast. And for people who want to listen to more of your analysis, go to YouTube, where we have an extended segment of the Miami Heat breakdown.
All right. Thanks again to David for joining us today. It was a great look into what's next for the Heat as well. And that will be all we can fit in today. So, busy news day, of course. Plenty more to come throughout the playoffs. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes or wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And thanks for listening to our live show on Locker Room. If you liked our show, please be sure to start your own room and engage with other fans on the app. Download the Locker Room app in the Apple App Store to be a part of our podcast. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You too, man.